sing it. Where?
In Seattle.
Sorry. The Duwamish tribe, whose roots in Seattle stretch back for millennia, are not recognized by the federal government, but they have found an ally now in a local author. Historian Felix Spinell is here to tell us about Chief Seattle biographer David Burgee, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, you know, yesterday was the 167th anniversary of the arrival of David Denny at what's now West Seattle. And, you know, the rest of the Denny party would arrive in November and would paddle across Elliott Bay a few months later and then found Seattle in February of 1852. Of course, Native Americans were here long before that, and Chief Seattle and the Duwamish tribe in particular were of great help to the settlers. But author and historian David Burgee says the Duwamish, who've not been federally recognized as a tribe for more than 50 years, have suffered a great injustice. He's been trying for the past 6 months to arrange a meeting between Mayor Jenny Durkin and Duwamish Tribal Chair Cecile Hansen.
If it weren't for the Duwamish, the settlers would have starved to death in the winter of 1852 and 3. You know, the Duwamish to help defend the town. They kept the mill running, and they've just been treated like dirt by the town and the city.
That's a complicated story, but the Duwamish signed the Treaty of Point Elliott at what's now Mukilteo in 1855, ceding their land and clearing the way for settlers. David Burgee says the natives thought the signing of the treaty was the beginning of negotiations about things like where to locate a reservation, but the federal government saw the treaty as the end of the process. Ultimately, the Duwamish ended up without a reservation and without much of anything.
The Duwamish are unrecognized. That means that they cannot receive the same benefits that recognized tribes do. So the Duwamish do not get any of the benefits of the federal treaties, and it was their chief, Seattle, who signed it, and the Duwamish are the first group listed in the treaty document.
Now, the official reasons the Duwamish aren't recognized include not having a continuous history and not maintaining political authority. David Burgee says to really understand why the Duwamish are stuck in kind of a landless limbo, you have to go back to the 1850s and 1860s, when Seattle's white settlers did all they could to keep the Duwamish from owning land in Seattle. He points to one specific incident around 1865 when the Duwamish were in talks with the federal government about establishing a reservation in West Seattle.
When word of that got back to Seattle, virtually the entire voting age population, which would have been white men over 21 years of age, they drew up a petition saying that, no, this would be unjust, that they take care of their Duwamish. There's no reason for the government to set up a reservation because they treat them kindly with compassion. And so it shouldn't go forward. And that was sent to the delegate, Arthur Denny, in the Congress in Washington, D.C., and the effort on the part of the Duwamish and the federal government was quashed.
And he says this petition was signed by all names we'd all recognize, like Henry Esler and the Dennys and Maynard. David Burgee says the incident from the 1860s is among the most egregious examples of how the Duwamish were excluded, even though he says they actually wanted to take part in the prosperity of building a city and trading with settlers. And Burgee says the exclusion went well beyond the 1860s.
The effort to keep the Duwamish out, to keep their land holdings out of the city, was continued. And it continues today, so that the mayor's office doesn't even respond to an invitation to talk with the Duwamish.
So he sent a letter to Mayor Durkin on behalf of Tribal Chair Cecile Hansen back in March to try to arrange a meeting between them, but it went nowhere. So he sent it again last week, and this time he CC'd me. You know, why is David Burgee even involved in this? He's been researching local history for more than 50 years. He's known the Duwamish for decades. He published this incredible biography of Chief Seattle late last year. And also, his wife was Jenny Durkin's teacher at Forest Ridge School in Bellevue many years ago. So there's a bit of a personal connection. Now, Burgee says he's not sanguine, but he's hopeful that a meeting between Mayor Durkin and Tribal Chair Hansen will happen and that it will be fruitful in that it could help the tribe get federal recognition. In any case, the city's silence on this issue in the past certainly hasn't helped, David Burgee says.
They avoided by essentially avoiding the issue. And this has been going on since the 1850s. And it's going on today. And so Mayor Durkin now has an opportunity to do something different. They often say, well, the Duwamish are Seattle native people and all that. And they make the pronouncements. They talk the talk, but it doesn't go beyond that. And what the Duwamish are asking for is support, support for recognition, and respect from the city that they helped found. And I think it's long overdue.
So, Felix, they were never forced onto a reservation then?
Well, they wanted to have a reservation within the Seattle area, but they were forced out of the city. They were offered land over on the east side of Hood Canal, but nobody wanted to settle over there because there was previously never any native village there. So they ended up kind of lost in the shuffle. And then 50 years ago, they were their recognition was taken away before all the Bolt decision, sharing fisheries stuff, and then all the stuff
with
gaming.
So if they're recognized now, what would that mean?
It would mean they would get some land somewhere. They get access to health and education
somewhere.
Programs.
I mean, they want it in the city, though.
Ideally. And they own property along the Duwamish. They built a longhouse in 2009, but they don't have an actual reservation. They don't have that federal recognition that would give them all sorts of access to things that they don't currently have.
So if they got it, that might mean a casino on their land along the Duwamish?
It would be perfectly within their rights to do that. They said they've never wanted a casino. I talked to Cecile Hansen yesterday. They said that has never been their goal, and they didn't say anything about that. But in my mind, that would be perfectly within their rights. And the other tribes, it's complicated by the other federally recognized tribes who don't want another federally recognized tribe in this area because they see it as a pie being cut up smaller and smaller. So it's a very complex issue, hard to do in a short period of time, but it's the tribe that was here before everyone else got here. They're the true Seattleites.
Felix Bunnell, brought to you by the King County Library System. Thanks, Felix. It was Scold Iran Day at the United Nations. Here's National Security Advisor John Bolton.
The Iran deal was, in fact, the worst diplomatic debacle in American history.
And this was President Trump before the assembled leaders of the world.
Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction.
Let's bring in CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, the Iran deal. Are we getting support from our European allies on punishing Iran for not doing enough?
It looks like we are, Dave. It looks like that the new sanctions will take place on November 4th. But European countries, according to the Secretary of State, are voting with their checkbooks and decided those companies are leaving. Now, it's the governments that we're still challenged with, but the companies themselves are recognizing that if they get in the crosshairs of the United States and the State Department, that they won't do business with them. So I do believe that what the president has put out there for more pressure to come from his European countries is having an effect. The sanctions have had an effect, and they're going to have a greater effect after November 4th, especially if we can wrap some of the oil nations like the Saudi Arabians into producing more oil so it makes up for the loss that some of those European countries will feel.
So even though European governments have been reluctant and been pretty vocal about how they're not going to drop out of the Iran deal, that doesn't matter if the companies themselves don't want to be associated with Iran.
That's right. And the ambassadors have been speaking to those companies in particular. You see the German ambassador, for example, Rich Grenell, he's on Twitter speaking to these German companies that have decided not to do business and praising them and making this a clear message to other companies that if they do business with the Iranian government, that the United States government won't do business with them. So the U.S. is kind of going around these central governments in Europe.
That's working then. All right. So remind us again, what is Iran up to that makes them so deplorable?
Well, I mean, they continue to undermine any kind of stability within the Middle East. They fund what's happening in Syria. They're funding Hezbollah groups and they look at Israel as an enemy of their state, likely still continuing on the missile programs and things that will deliver potential nuclear weapons. They say they're complying with the nuclear deal. However, it's still all self-reported. We don't really know if that's the case. No one's been inside to see what's going on there. Satellite photos don't show anything above the ordinary, but again, we know that they moved a significant amount of their capability underground. So Iran is saying that they are in compliance, but they do continue to be a tremendous irritant and someone within the Middle Eastern community that creates chaos and sows destruction, as the president said.
Okay, yesterday after the president's speech calling out Iran, here's what the Iranian leader Rouhani said. Quote, it's unfortunate that we are witnessing rulers in the world who think they can gain popular support through the fomenting of extremist nationalism and racism and through xenophobic tendencies resembling a Nazi disposition. Didn't name Trump specifically, but we know who he was referring to. So what kind of cards do they have to play here?
They don't have a lot. I think when someone calls someone else a Nazi, then you've kind of gone to the most extreme you're going to get here at this point. But diplomatically, it doesn't matter to us. I think the Iranians have a challenge internally. They had an event over the weekend where they had an attack on one of the military parades. They're blaming the United States for that. And they could have this revolution that could take place from within. Now, the U.S. does not look to have regime change. We're not going to actively seek that. We want to change the behavior of the Iranian government. I still think Trump wants to do a deal. That's his game. He wants to have the same kind of success with Iran that he feels he's had success with North Korea. Because notice this whole pivot away from the United Nations went from North Korea towards Iran. We thought we were going to have more things to put out here at this U.N. General Assembly meeting about North Korea, but there really isn't. And that's why I think the pivot went to Iran. He wants to do a deal with Iran. There's no question that's better than the one that the previous administration did.
So really, well, I mean, that I mean, we think back to next year, last year. Last year he was calling North Korea, you know, Kim Jong-un, little rocket man. Now they're best of friends. You think a year from now that could be our relationship with Iran too?
Yeah, I mean, that would be pretty extreme. He called him a lovely person in a tweet a couple of days ago. I mean, he's the most, you know, passive-aggressive negotiator that you see out there. But, again, we just have to see. The Iranians are different culture. That I think there's a lot more at stake for them. I think they're, frankly, better negotiators on some level from a cultural perspective. And I think, in North Korea, you've got the South Korean influence. There's really no external forces influencing Iran other than the European communities. And I guess John Kerry telling them to just kind of wait out. The president will eventually be out of there. If they want to wait, 4 or 8 years, that's their choice to do.
On the bigger theme of the president's remarks, which was to embrace nationalism, he said, I'm for America. You guys should be for each of your countries. Patriotism is good. Nationalism is good. How do you feel about that?
Well, so look at the last 70 years and the fact that these European economies that were tied together from a liberal perspective has worked in terms of maintaining the peace on the European continent. These countries went to war for the past 1,000 years with each other, but it really still hasn't solved the problem of the economic imbalance that takes place throughout the world, and the fact that the Chinese continue to steal our intellectual property, they cheat on trade. The Russians still are a military threat that's out there. So, the experts, are experts, but they might have been wrong. And to say that to go to this globalization, at some point you do have to retreat to your corners and do what you do well. Right now, the Trump administration is just betting that the U.S. economy is just still going to be stronger than all those out there combined in some level. It's going to make up whatever trade that they were going to do with the Iranians for those European companies. Whether that's the case or not remains to be seen. The Chinese, I believe, with 1 billion people and their economy roaring at 7, 8, 9% growth on an annual basis, still is a pretty formidable foe and eventually will take over the world as the number one economy.
Yeah. CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. In the Huffington Post, in their Highline section where they do their long-form articles, is a long article titled "Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong." It's written by Michael Hobbs, and you wrote it because of your mom. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a chip on my shoulder about this issue for decades. This was one of the central features of my childhood, was that my mom struggled with her weight, always. And she was always trying really hard. She was always on a diet. It was cabbage soup, or it was lemons, or it was Granny Smith apples, or whatever it was. She was swimming 5 days a week. She was biking to lots of the places that she went. And her weight went up a little bit or down a little bit, but it never fluctuated all that much. And the message that she always got was, you're not trying hard enough. And so growing up,
just from doctors and
from her friends and from, everybody. I mean, this was the overwhelming message that she received. And I just remember seeing that even as a kid, I could see how mean everybody was being to my mom, and I could see how hard she was trying. And something just didn't link up to me.
Well, your point is that doesn't work, and in fact, it backfires on the person you're supposedly trying to help.
Yeah, and I've now had long conversations with my mom about this, that, in her 20s and 30s, nobody ever said to her, it's actually okay to just be a little bit bigger than society wants you to be. It's actually okay to just try to eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day and try to get some exercise. And
well, a little bit bigger, but if you become obese, doctors agree that's unhealthy. Right?
Well, first of all, it's important to unpack this. I mean, there are unhealthy fat people and there are healthy fat people and there are a lot of unhealthy skinny people, too. I mean, we all have that friend who eats tons and rarely exercises and never gains weight. A lot of those people actually have metabolic problems, and a lot of those people end up with cardiovascular problems later in their lives. And yet, most of us don't actually care. I don't ask my friends what their resting heart rate is. I don't ask them what their LDL cholesterol is.
Right.
And I don't treat them poorly based on their habits because everybody's allowed to eat too much at Thanksgiving dinner. I don't particularly care. It's only if they look a certain way that all of a sudden I pretend to care about how many brownies they had or how many slices of pumpkin pie they had. I think the most important thing is that, first of all, weight and health are much more complicated than we think they are. And secondly, shaming people is much worse for them than eating poorly. I mean, when you talk to fat people, it's the kind of abuse that they're getting from doctors, from their family members. It's the number one reason that children are bullied at school, the number one reason. People are judging them in restaurants. People are judging them on public transit. They feel, a lot of fat people told me, they feel flexed whenever they're in public because they're waiting for the next bully, the next negative interaction.
Are you moving towards making fat people a protected class?
I mean, it's actually interesting in that it is illegal to fire somebody for their weight in one state. Mm-hmm. It is perfectly legal to fire somebody for their weight basically everywhere, everywhere but Michigan. And what's really interesting about that is everyone says, well, being fat is a choice, so it can't be a protected class. Yeah. But becoming pregnant, it's illegal to fire somebody for becoming pregnant. Becoming pregnant is a choice. Mm-hmm. It's illegal to fire somebody for switching their religions. If I become a Scientologist, my boss cannot fire me for that. If I gain 15 pounds, my boss can fire me for that. That feels unfair to me. And so I actually think in the law, it's perfectly fine for us to have a protected class that our appearance, if you're an accountant, your appearance doesn't affect your job. Like if you're a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, fine. You know, you need to have a certain weight. However, right. if in my job, I'm a journalist, I could be 300 pounds, I could be 500 pounds. It doesn't really matter for my ability to do my job. And yet it's actually fine to post job ads that say no fat people, please. And that has happened. And it's extremely dehumanizing. And when you look at the statistics, fat people earn less. They're less likely to get jobs after they interview. They're less likely to get into college if there's an interview component. There's all kinds of structural forms of discrimination that are completely counterintuitive. And it's not helping anybody. Like, this has real consequences.
We make a pretty good case. Do you? But is it as bad now as it has been? I mean, for example, we have a number of models of people in show business. Melissa McCarthy, although she's lost a lot of weight recently, but you know, Roseanne, although she lost her job too. But I mean, we certainly have public figures who are not ashamed of being heavier than, you know, what's considered ideal.
I mean, I think that's a good thing, in the same way that any minority representation is a good thing, and anything that humanizes people that we don't necessarily get, you know, see humanized normally, I think that's a good thing. So that is good. However, I think we see these little pockets of improvement, but we don't see the ways that we're backsliding. So one of the things that really bugs me and that I've really started to notice since I started writing this article is, what are the jokes that we make about Donald Trump? They are his weight, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of it is this boring high school level stuff about how fat he is, or Chris Christie. Every time Chris Christie's corruption, insane, like Zimbabwe level corruption, is in the news, what do? We make a joke about, oh, if he'd put down the M&Ms, maybe he would be a better governor. Right. And it's like vaudeville 1950s level jokes, when Chris Christie does not hear that. Chris Christie is not listening to your jokes, but your fat friend is, and it's hurting mm-hmm. them. And they're wondering, well, what do you say about
That's
me?
A good point.
What do you think about my morality?
Yeah.
And so what is wrong with Chris Christie and Donald Trump is who they are as people. If Donald Trump had a six-pack, he'd still be a terrible person. I really don't want to hear weight jokes about him. And so a lot of fat people have said that it's been really difficult for them.
The news here is the writer for the Huffington Post sticking up for Donald Trump and Chris Christie.
No. I just think we should fight the real enemy, which is who they are as people and what they do. And I think that's really all fat people want, is judge me on who I am and what I do and not how I look. And we should change the way that we talk about this issue, that it's people are different, and people are different for ways that are none of my business. I don't know why somebody's 300 pounds. I can just let them alone.
Michael Hobbs writes for the Huffington Post, and he's got a podcast which is called You're Wrong About, where I assume he selects subjects that everybody's wrong about and tells them why they're wrong.
Yeah, we're doing Shaken Baby Syndrome this week.
Shaken Baby Syndrome?
Yeah. Not real. It's not a real
thing.
There's
no such thing as shaken baby syndrome.
You got to listen in, man. It's a good show.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Cheers.
7:48, time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is from that tsunami of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle, Danny O'Neill. Gambling. For the longest time, I could not understand why people would spend hours and hours listening to sports radio. I mean, besides to appreciate your talent. But, you know, why would they spend all day listening to it? And then I realized that they had money on these games.
Oh, that's not true. I don't believe that's true.
Not at all, huh?
There's certainly some people. People are not. It is not a gamble. If you are interested in gambling, like that's your primary interest in sports is the money you have riding on games, there's better people than me to listen to, because we don't talk about point spreads that much. We don't spend as much time.
But you talk about injuries.
Sure.
You talk in great detail about injuries and the prospects for a certain player being in a game or not. Isn't that the kind of information you need to make an informed bet?
Yes, it is. And if that was the primary thing that you wanted from your consumption, you would find better programs than ours. This is terrible advertising for our show. But honestly, because we summarize the injury reports, yeah. But you can get that in about 30 seconds by going to a website.
I'm not necessarily against it, though. I'm just trying to figure out a way to extend that to news betting so that people could put money on, you know, how many times I'd say sex in a commentary.
Yeah, people do it. I'll tell you that I've got a friend who was recovering from shoulder surgery about the time of the Republican primaries, and he made a significant amount of money betting on Trump. Because as he watched the debates, he was like, Trump is going to tear through all of these people. And he's not a Trump enthusiast. Yeah. In fact, I would describe him as a political opponent of Trump. But just watching, you can bet on news events.
So that's already legal.
Legal, illegal. It's all blue. It's all a gray area. You can do it on the internet.
Yeah, that's true. So a number of states, since the Supreme Court decision, a number of states have legalized gambling. So it's not, it used to be just Nevada, right?
Yes, you could do it in Nevada. And in Nevada, you can't bet on events that are happening there in the state. That's generally the, up until last year when the Supreme Court made this ruling regarding New Jersey, that was the operating law.
Okay, but now the news here is that the NFL, which used to oppose this, is now embracing it because they figure they can make more money that way.
Yes, the NBA has led the charge and the NFL is probably in suit. In step with them of saying, yeah, we're okay with gambling. We just want a cut of it. We want a percentage of every bet that is placed on our league that we feel that because you are making money, taking bets off of our events, we should get a slice of that.
Well, now how does that work? So do the Republicans get a slice of the prop bets that were based on the Republican convention?
Absolutely not. And that's an interesting question for me. And I guess the way that the things that the NFL can withhold, because they can't stop them from taking bets, would be things like logos, the way that you advertise the betting, that you couldn't advertise that you're betting on NBA games. You couldn't use their trademarks, things like that. But they can't prevent you from taking a bet in a state where sports gambling is legal on an event involving two of their teams.
Even if they don't get a cut, though, isn't it true that if you've got money on a game, you're much more likely to watch that game or even go to that game?
Yeah. Yes. I would say watch. I'm not sure how much that affects actual attendance, but you're certainly more geared and tuned into. And not only that, but if you win, you're more likely to bet on that league again, which is going to make you, in that way, a more devoted patron. What do McDonald's call it? Heavy users? People that ate 20 of their meals in a month?
I've never been a gambler. And I've been to a racetrack, I think, once or twice. I remember, and this is how bad it is. I go to a racetrack, and I'm sitting next to a friend, and I'm looking at the horses go around. And I say, I just don't find this interesting. And he turns to me and says, put some money on a horse, Dave, and then you'll find it interesting.
Did you do it?
Yeah, I did.
How did it work?
I lost.
Were you more interested?
Oh, yes.
Now, it's really...
Until I lost, then I said, this is an easy way to lose money. I'll go to the stock market instead. Where it's safer.
Yeah, I'm a terrible gambler. I don't like doing it. I sweat it out. I like being around gambling, and I like watching the trends, and I'm fascinated by the subject. It's a really interesting question about... And then you get into the issues of actual gambling addiction and those sort of things. This has been the third rail for most sports leagues. Yeah. They've been terrified of gambling scandals. That's
the other thing. I mean, you want to make sure players don't get involved in that, right?
Correct, because you talk about it's not just on the outcome of games, but it's on point spreads, and there's all sorts of different ways they can do it. For years, for decades, the leagues were terrified of this, and now never underestimate. What was the H.L. Mencken line? No one ever went broke.
Underestimating the intelligence of the American people.
No one ever went broke underestimating the greed. No, I guess it would be overestimating the greed of sports leagues.
There you go.
Did I get it right finally?
I don't know.
Who knows?
Pick it up now. Thank you, Danny.
Bye.
It's time for Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. First responders are going to be pushed to the max tomorrow in a full-scale emergency drill inside the new 99 tunnel. Cairo Radio's Chris Sullivan is here with a look at what they're going to face. Chris.
Okay, it's one of the last major testing hurdles before the tunnel can be opened to the public. A mass casualty training exercise designed to be as realistic as possible. It's going to start with a major crash inside the tunnel.
8 cars and 3 buses, and we'll have upwards of 24 folks that are injured, and they'll actually have simulated makeup on to demonstrate those injuries and make it as realistic as possible for responders.
Wow.
And we'll also have a number of other individuals that will be self-evacuating the tunnel and will force us to have to do sweeps of the tunnel and make sure everybody gets out safely.
8 cars and 3 buses.
Yeah, some of them are going to be overturned. There's going to be a simulated fire. There's going to be smoke. They're going to test the deluge system. So this is about as close to the real thing as they can get. That was Brittany Miller, the deputy emergency manager for the Washington Department of Transportation. She says the key to this exercise is to make sure that all the different agencies that would respond to something like this can work together.
We picked this scenario we picked on purpose, and it's one of our more complex ones. Multiple vehicles, multiple injuries, and it involves different levels of all of our responses. So we're going to get some really key lessons learned from that, that we will use the time until the opening to incorporate those lessons learned into our plans and procedures and continue to refine them until the tunnel does open.
Captain Eric Sanu with the Seattle Police Department says it's essential to take their preparations off the tabletop, which they've been doing a ton of, and put them into action with this simulation.
Just to see how we can maneuver our vehicles in there, how we can maneuver fire vehicles, police vehicles, tow trucks, how we can tow buses, cars out of there if need be.
But Captain Sanu admits there is one variable that they cannot prepare for.
One thing we cannot predict is human behavior, right? We don't know what's going to happen when people see a deluge system in front of them. We don't know what people are going to do. Hopefully, when an incident occurs, people will be able to hear the messaging that's happening, listen to what's going on, stay in their cars. If we need to tow them out or turn them around, we'll be able to do that in the tunnel.
As I mentioned, there will also be a simulated fire inside the tunnel as part of this drill. Miller was asked, why not the real thing?
The fire is purely simulated with strobe lights and that sort of thing. We're not actually going to set the tunnel on fire.
So that's probably a good thing, to not set the tunnel on fire.
Yeah.
Now, if you're in the South Lake Union area tomorrow near the north portal of the tunnel, expect to see a lot of activity, a lot of emergency responders. It's going to look like the real deal. Most of it will kind of be inside the tunnel, so you won't necessarily see much, but just in case you realize, and this is going to be happening sometime late morning to early afternoon tomorrow.
Well, to me, the scariest thing is an explosion of a truck carrying something flammable. I assume they have a mammoth air exchange system that would suck all that out of the tunnel.
Yes, they do. And the thing that's interesting about this tunnel, it's about as automated of a tunnel as you can get. In fact, the sprinkler systems, the air system, the cameras are even automated. So they'll turn to something based on what they sense, and they'll actually start the emergency procedure before someone in the emergency management center might even realize there's something going on. Mm-hmm. So they'll actually start that response. And the other thing that I found that was very interesting that they discussed at length yesterday is how they're going to get in and out of the tunnel based on whether there's a crash. Like, say, for instance, there's a crash in the south, in the northbound direction, which is in the lower deck of this tunnel. They're going to enter in the southbound direction, the top deck, drive their vehicles there, get to the nearest point that they think they are above the crash, then go down and use the stair system to get down below to access that, to get their initial look. So if there's a crash maybe on that lower deck, they might have to block a lane in the upper deck for their first initial attack. Because if you think about it, if there's a crash in that, you know, in that tube, it's
they'll
a 2-mile backup.
Yeah.
They'll never get there. So they're going to attack it coming in the other direction. Once they realize what they're dealing with, they'll then close the tunnel, stop traffic behind the crash potentially, and then roll people in the opposite direction of the same level.
Have you seen the deluge system in operation?
Yes, I have.
What is it? So they said that this might really shock people. So is it shocking?
Well, I mean, if something comes down and you're not expecting to drive into what is basically a high-powered car wash,
mm-hmm.
when you're going 40 miles an
so
hour based on... Yeah, I mean, we posted the video of one of their tests of the deluge system at MyNorthwest.com earlier. It's also on the DOT's page. I mean, it doesn't fool around.
Yeah.
I mean, it drops a ton of water with a high velocity. And so, you know, and also with smoke in a tunnel.
Are you blinded? I mean, should you turn your windshield wipers
on
and keep
they
driving?
They didn't drive anybody through it. We had it when the pictures were staged from behind. But I'd imagine going through it when you weren't expecting it, if something's just in front of you, it could be quite jarring, having never gone through that. So those that they can't test for us, the public, but they're out going to test pretty darn hard tomorrow on everything but us.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. He has been called America's most famous illegal because he is not here legally, and yet he is here and considers himself a citizen. Jose Antonio Vargas, you've done pretty well for yourself, including winning the Pulitzer Prize. First of all, you're going out on this tour. You're going to be at Town Hall on Friday. And as I understand it, you are liable to be basically arrested and deported mid-speech if they want to.
Well, I mean, that's the reality for any undocumented person in the country, especially under the Trump administration. So, yeah.
You came here at the age of 12, sent here by your mom. Before we get around to why you decided to essentially out yourself, you mention in the book that it was the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, which basically caused our crisis on the southern border. Explain that to me.
Interestingly enough, that act in 1965, which is why, you know, that got rid of the racial-based immigration quotas, right? But what ended up happening was it ended up hurting Mexico, in particular immigrants who were coming here and who just wanted to come here for work. So that and you compound that with, for example, NAFTA and what NAFTA did not only to the American worker, but what it did to the Mexican worker and how that impacted the Mexican economy. These are the kind of questions, by the way, that we don't talk about whenever immigration comes up, right? Meaning, what are the root causes of migration patterns? No one wants to break the law.
So you're saying it was the quotas that caused the problem?
It was the quotas that made it, quote unquote, illegal for Mexican immigrants to come to this country. Before that, the migration was based, I mean, you remember this country had a Bracero program, for example, when Mexican workers can seasonally come to America and go back to Mexico. So whatever happened to that program? Why did we get rid of it? So that was my part of kind of, again, investigating what policies have led up to the moment that we're in now. Like, for example, if I decided to leave the country, right, and I've been here for 25 years, I couldn't come back. I would face what's called a 10-year bar. That's because of what Bill Clinton signed into law when he was president in the mid-90s. So when people say to me, for example, that why don't I just get in the back of the line or why don't I just get legal? People don't actually understand that there is no such line to get in the back of. It doesn't exist. That's why there's 11 million of us.
So the irony here is that by making it more difficult to cross the border legally, you basically guarantee you're going to have a large illegal population here.
Yeah. And mind you, about 40% of the 11 million undocumented population overstayed their visa.
Yeah.
They didn't cross the border. Most of the American public doesn't know what this is. Simple facts like there is no process for me to just, quote unquote, make myself legal. Something like, oh, we pay billions of dollars in taxes and Social Security. I can't tell you how many Republicans, the moment they hear that, they go crazy. They go like, what? Fox News doesn't say that. Well, yeah, Fox News doesn't say that. Most of the American public doesn't know what this issue is. We have not really told them.
I think the way to break through is for people to meet undocumented aliens. Or whatever you want to call them. I mean, one of my first stories, and this was, I've been here 40 years, so this was probably about 35 years ago. I asked a local relief agency, you know, introduce me to some people who are here illegally. And they did. And you meet these people, and they're living underground, and yet they're hardworking. They're scared to death that they won't even speed because the last thing they want to do is get pulled over by a cop. And I said, yikes, absent the document problem, these would be considered model citizens. But most people, of course, are never going to meet people who they know to be here illegally and change their image.
But this is why this has to happen at all levels, right? But actually, in our organization at Define American, we have an entire coming out campaign. So if you're ready to actually divulge your undocumented status and you're ready to kind of talk to your community members, please go to us. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the other people who should be coming out are the people who support us. You know, I made a very conscious effort in this book with their permission to name every single American who's ever helped me out. Because I think they're a part of the conversation. Like, I could not have survived in this country and, you know, become who I am without them. I would argue that the stories of these good Samaritans are the one that is sorely lacking when we talk about this issue.
Yeah. So at your town hall event, are you welcoming people who wish you weren't here?
Oh, my God. Absolutely. That's why I go on Fox News. That's why I go on conservative talk radio. Absolutely. Like, I did not do this 7 years ago, and I'm not doing this now just so I can talk to people who agree with me.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't agree with me, please, let's go talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's try to figure out why you don't agree with me.
And do people end up being convinced, or do they say, well, okay, Jose, in your case, you're a Pulitzer Prize winner, you've written a book, you seem like a nice guy, we'll let you stay, but I'm sorry the others have to go.
And that's precisely why I haven't left. Because this is way bigger than me. I'm one person. Like, you know, I don't want to play into the good immigrant model minority. Oh, you sound so nice. You know, when the reality is all of us have stories that we're carrying. And immigration is about families, what families do for each other. And the families that you create when you don't have one here. Right? My mom, you know, I haven't seen her since for 25 years. And it didn't become really clear until I was writing this book that I've been collecting mother figures my entire life.
That's true. If you haven't got a family, you got to make one somehow.
Yes.
Dear America is the name of Jose Antonio Vargas's book. Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. The word citizen underlined right there in the cover. He's going to be at Town Hall 7:30 Friday night here in Seattle. Jose, great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your time, Dave.